Well, g'day everyone, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Rebecca Weiser, an experienced journalist who currently serves as the editor of Quadrant and was formerly the long-standing opinion page editor of The Australian. Today we discuss the five-year anniversary of the COVID lockdowns and what she learned from her experience of that time, her thoughts on the media today, and whether she was surprised the chairman of the ABC had no idea about Joe Rogan, whether there are any ideological elements of the Howard Bush era that were in retrospect wrong and are inappropriate for today, and where she differs from the Trump agenda, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Rebecca Weiser, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me, Dan.
No problem. I really appreciate you coming on. There's a lot of things I'd love to discuss, but we're at the five-year anniversary now of the introduction of COVID-era restrictions and lockdowns in Australia. You, I think, in my view at least, were one of the few mainstream journalists who can hold their head high for the way you behaved during that time. Do you think there'll ever be a proper reckoning for the gross overreaction by our government and media that occurred during that time?
It's hard to say, but my feeling as it was happening, as the breadth and the depth of the mistakes unrolled, my feeling was that it would take a very long time. And, when I was born, the thalidomide problem was happening in Australia. My mother actually took thalidomide, was prescribed thalidomide for a month for morning sickness. And luckily, she decided that it actually made her feel more sick and didn't take it. So I've always had a sense that there, but for the grace of God, go I, because there were kids that I went to school with, and I certainly saw them, not so much now, sadly, because it shortened their lifespan, but of course, also kids were born without limbs. And it took a long while. There was an apology that was issued to the children ended up being born without proper limbs due to thalidomide, but that happened during the COVID period. And when it happened, I thought, gosh, it's a lot of decades for that apology. So I think a full undertaking, I think it'll take a very long time. I hope it doesn't. And I really hope that at least some aspects of it are recognised, because there is a very real sense in which those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it. But I think it'll take a long time. I think often it's, you have to wait till the guilty parties have literally died.
You've written a lot of things as a journalist and been the op-ed editor of The Australian, and now you're the editor of Quadrant. So you've read and you've made a lot of conflicting views in your time, in your professional career. Did you ever experience a situation where there was such uniformity of opinion and intolerance for dissenting views as during the COVID era?
No, I think it was truly a new experience for me to see that, and it was quite. I still look back on it now and can't quite believe that it happened here in Australia. I think up until that time, I'd often met people, for example, who lived in countries like what was then Czechoslovakia, who ended up coming to Australia after the Prague Spring, and would tell you how it was, a country full of very bright people and great writers and so forth. So how did they end up under the boot of Soviet communism, for all those decades? And I really felt there was a way in which I discovered how that could happen, how intelligent people could suddenly accept something that was clearly intellectually wrong. And that's what I think happened under communism. And I'm not saying there was a strange way in which there was a parallel process that happened here, although it was very different. You know, it was like that, but it was not like that. But it still involved a group of intelligent people suddenly accepting that things that weren't true, or not just that things that weren't true could be true, but also that the way in which we test whether something was true had to be suspended. We weren't allowed simply to subject things to open debate, for example, which is the fundamental way you test the truth of an idea, is by testing it to debate.
How do we guard against that groupthink in future?
I think it's very hard, you know. I mean, COVID was an extreme case, but I think groupthink is very common and not always as extreme. I mean, I see that the whole way in which people have not been allowed to dissent about climate change and a lot of the so-called science behind climate change is similar, but not nearly as extreme. Very highly qualified people, Nobel laureates in physics, no less. I think the Nobel laureate for physics only in 2022 was deplatformed because he's a climate skeptic. I mean, Steve Coonan, you know, who was Obama's undersecretary for science, you know, and written a very good book on the subject, Unsettled. You know, it's simply, you know, pushed aside. And I think certainly for people who are not at the stage in their academic career, who are not emeritus professors, their careers are blocked or ended. And that, I think, is sort of, that part of it was the part that looked to me a lot like communism, you know, and friends who were journalists who ended up driving buses, for example, you know, simply because they didn't want to get vaccinated, and people whose funding in universities couldn't, you know, were stopped, or they're discredited, you know, chained and so forth. It's really, it's a terrible time, but, you know, how do we protect against it? Courage, I think, is the main thing. It comes down to people having the courage to be truthful.
Yeah, it's a combination of, like, well, analytical ability. It was a multifactorial problem which arose, but people were not able to apply sort of a logical process to work out the true scale of the risk, and just went, and just, it just all became emotion. And then the people who did know didn't speak up like they should have done. But there were people, right? I mean, there were highly qualified people, Sunetra Gupta, Jay Bhattacharya, and others. And I find at least cause for hope the fact that a guy like that is now the head of the National Institutes for Disease in the United States. Like, it's almost been this incredible heroic journey where a guy who was professor of Stanford was completely kicked off Twitter, but has now come back and is going to be setting policy in the United States. But nothing like that has happened in Australia. We haven't had the same type of situation where those who were kicked off are now welcomed back and put up in lights. Just down the road from me, Jeanette Young, who is the chief medical officer here in chief health officer here in Queensland, is still in the governor's mansion as the highly lauded governor of Queensland. I mean, when do the doctors who were right and were speaking up in Queensland and lost their license and stuff, when do they get to be, you know, recognized for their heroic stands, right? I just see no evidence of that yet.
No, well, I think even in the United States, what we've seen is that in the end, there used to be a lot of debate about the protections for freedom of speech and whether it was better to have a written constitution and so forth, or whether it was better to have, you know, time-honored traditions. Well, I think what we've seen is that the US, you know, with its constitutional rights and amendments, has been much more robust in protecting freedom of speech ultimately. But even so, this area of health, I think what people like me who just tried to report what was happening, what we started to realize was that the problem was much bigger and much older than we had understood. I mean, I went into COVID, not really thinking that there were any particular problems in the area of medical research, pharmaceuticals. And by the end of 5 years, you know, it had been this sort of, I felt like I'd done a master's degree in everything that was wrong and with the way the current system works, and even in the United States. And I think the short answer to your question is that the solution or even the accounting will come first in the United States before it comes to Australia. There is simply, like so many other things, these trends and thought processes start in the United States and then filter out through the Anglosphere. And I think it'll be true for the accounting. It'll start in the United States and then Australian authorities will be forced to accommodate it, because a lot of our regulatory bodies take their lead from US regulatory bodies. So as changes are made there, people here and authorities here will be forced to bring them on board.
And I think some of the joint research, which is partly funded by the US, that may change. We're seeing a little bit of that in the university sector, where the Trump administration is requiring new universities to ensure they don't engage in, you know, highly questionable ideological campaigns. So I suspect in due course some of the funding that the US provides to Australia in the medical sector will also similarly hopefully drive some positive change there. Last question on COVID. Who disappointed you most during that time?
I think it's really hard to say, but I guess, you know, because the way our system is meant to work is that we have power is, and rightly, distributed throughout various groups. And so those are meant to act as checks and balances on each other. And I think in a way, at the heart of the problem, really, much and all as you might be disappointed by individuals, but the problem in a way was the regulatory authorities, I think. So even good people and intelligent people and reasonable people who wanted to speak up, I think felt that curtailed their own logic by saying, well, surely the Therapeutic Goods Administration would say if there was a problem. But that actually was where, you know, people felt like they had to defer to the scientific or medical authority embodied in that, even when everything that we know told us that, for a start, for example, that it is simply impossible to develop a safe vaccine in this period of a few months. It can't be done. And that even when this had gained approval, it was based on an emergency authorization. And therefore, the whole notion of mandating it was clearly a violation of people's rights, especially when we saw people dying. And the notion that for this virus, that we saw and we were told very large numbers of people, like maybe as much as 30%, would get it without even knowing that they had it. But they all had to take this, what you know, this sort of COVID roulette, this lottery of a vaccination that we knew killed some people. even the authorities admitted it and somehow thought that that was an acceptable risk. We wouldn't say to people, well, you have to drive this, you know, Kia Picanto. We know, you know, maybe 10 or 20 of you will get killed in the process. We wouldn't accept that with other goods and services, that there was this sort of fatal risk. And yet somehow that was okay because we were in some sort of a health crisis. Nonetheless, I do think that that is where you have to have much more rigor. The problem here was a scientific and a medical problem. So that, you know, yes, it was disappointing to me that journalists didn't question it. Yes, it was disappointing to me that lawyers simply could not see within all of the laws that we have to protect our rights, you know, any way to protect the rights of people, simply to exercise the very simple right to say, well, I'll decide what medical treatment I accept or don't accept. And the demonization of that was appalling. The emotional response from people, the failure of our parliamentarians, the failure of the Liberal Party, which is meant to be the party, obviously, of, you know, thinkers like John Stuart Mill. Yeah, there was a lot to be disappointed about. And I think until each of those, you know, bodies that had some sort of responsibility, A, accepts that they failed, and B, looks at why, then we are at risk of repeating the error.
Yeah. Let's maybe turn to the media more generally in Australia. Kim Williams is chairman of the ABC and was formerly CEO of News Limited, and he addressed the National Press Club, I think, a couple of months back, and someone asked him about Joe Rogan, and it was quite clear from his response that he was not familiar with the biggest podcaster in the world today. And I was thinking, you know, and you wrote on about this in the Spectator, and it was just surprising, not that he came at it from a, you know, clearly a sort of leftish wing perspective, but that someone in senior management and media simply had no idea about the competitive landscape in the media. How do you explain that?
I think that's really easy to explain. There is no, the ABC is not exposed to any competitive pressure. So why should we expect senior management to bother their pretty little heads with how do we compete with Joe Rogan? They don't have to. They have more than $1 billion every year and they can do what they like with it. And governments come and governments go and still they are there and their audience keeps declining. So of course they don't care and they don't know. And what does it matter? You know, they are do their own fact check themselves, check whether they've done anything wrong. You know, they're the judge and the jury on whether they've, you know, met the criteria for their charter. Nothing is less surprising, really, than that they have no idea what's going on in the world.
It just surprised me that because he was the CEO of News Limited previously, and I just thought he would be a little bit more curious and interested in commercial developments in the media sector, to simply have no real idea about, you know, the biggest podcaster in the world. It just struck me as...
But it was sort of... do you think anybody, they're not, it doesn't really surprise me, you know, and all he knew about Rogan, whatever he said about Rogan was wrong, and it was all very ideological. Oh, you know, he didn't like what Rogan was very dangerous because he said that he'd taken ivermectin, and, you know, that was a really dangerous thing to say. You know, it was sad and pathetic how out of touch he was, but it really wasn't surprising. Right. I'd have been surprised if he'd known who Rogan was and actually recognized, you know, why he was so popular and even thought that, you know, maybe the ABC should move with the times and be able to respond to that. That would have been surprising to me. So,
what do you think of new media generally? Podcasts, Twitter, you know, the whole range of new platforms that have developed, you know, the positives and the negatives?
Well, we're starting to do podcasts at, I've wanted to do it since I started at Quadrant 12 months ago, just a bit over. And so we were in the middle of launching a new website, and then we've had to fine tune that to get it operational. But all along, I've wanted to move into podcasts. I was very much guided by my mother, who was an avid reader of Quadrant. The revelation at Audible, talking books were for her. She lived to 92 and a half, and she loved reading. And I just remember how much she loved listening to Jordan Peterson on Audible. Even she started at age 90 or so. So that really inspired me. I thought most Quadrant readers tend to be, at the moment, they're 65 and over. So I thought a lot of people, their eyesight is not so good, then they may or may not be aware of podcasts, but I think they're going to like them. So we're just now starting that. And I think it'll go well. We put our first podcast out about a week ago, and we're getting a really good response. So I think these new media platforms are wonderful in the sense that they just make it easier to bring intelligent and interesting ideas to people in a whole range of places that they couldn't get them before. They make it easier to research a whole lot of ideas. They make it easier to be creative. They've lowered the barriers to entry in so many ways. And what I really was struck with in COVID was the amazing role that Twitter played. I had never really used Twitter before COVID, and I just got in touch with amazing people, including Jay Bhattacharya. You know, you could be on a direct line via Twitter with these people when everything was shut down. All of the stuff that I found out about how the virus escaped from the lab in Wuhan was all via Twitter, and an amazing group of people who were doing this incredible, they became these sort of viral hunter detectives in real time. So it was very exciting to follow what they were doing and to try to understand, because every so often they'd say things with only, I think, a PhD in virology had ever hope of understanding what they were talking about.
The smartest people are on Twitter. And like you, actually, I didn't really properly engage with it until COVID, when I was just desperate for news. I sometimes wonder, though, whether, in a way, social media caused the panic with all the pictures of good-looking Italian doctors in Milan freaking out about the rest of it, and posting pictures which weren't properly scrutinized. And then the mainstream media sort of latched onto that. But the information coming out through Twitter was definitely people should have been focusing on that a lot more, rather than official releases from the Therapeutic Goods Administration or God knows who else. But there's still a divide, I think, Rebecca, between, in Australia, people who only read the broadsheets or the online news, and those who actually do engage with Twitter. I find family and friends and everything else, it's almost as though you're inhabiting two different worlds, and that gap needs to be bridged eventually. It's almost like not worth arguing with people sometimes, but just directing them onto Twitter and saying, you know, just check out this source of news, because it tends to be, you know, a week or two ahead of what is often appears in the Australian or the Australian Financial Review, or God knows what else. What do you make of people like Tucker Carlson?
Well, I watched his latest interview with Steve Witkoff, and I guess you can be, it's very illuminating, is what I'd say. But I'm disappointed in the sense that I used to really enjoy, I wasn't always watching Fox News. I mean, I tended to watch, you know, Sky in Australia and, you know, click on to Tucker Carlson if I heard that, you know, he had some interesting interview or whatever. But I enjoyed it now I really, I think I've diverged from, you know, from feeling like he was somehow, I guess in my mind, I hadn't really thought about who he represented when he fell out with Fox. I guess that raised in a question, what was behind that? Why did it happen? But more and more, the interviews that he's conducted and the things that he said, I think starting the eye-opener for me was the interview he did with Putin, which I just thought was extraordinary for what he didn't ask Putin. And sure, he said, oh, well, lots of other people ask those questions, you know. But I think it was all part of essentially, you know, sanitizing or, you know, just the great ignoring of the reality of the power politics in Putin's Russia and what happens to people. And I watched not all of it, but, you know, the key moments, I guess, that curated by Twitter, the interview with Steve Witkoff, and I found that, I mean, I just look at these people and I think, wow, this is, I don't know, it's disturbing to me how they can be so naive and present opinions. I mean, watching Steve Witkoff talk about, for example, how moved he was when Putin gave him, you know, that Putin was really upset when Trump was almost, you know, assassinated, and he got the best painter in Russia to do a portrait, and he gave it to Steve, and Steve took it back. And I just, honestly, my background is diplomacy, you know. So, you know, frankly, Witkoff just seemed like a kid. He just seemed so naive. And, you know, Tucker and Ian were there. Oh, wow, Putin, he's so nice. You know, this is ridiculous. It's just laughable, you know. Steve, go visit Alexei Navalny's mum, you know. Ask about how nice. Go to the grave of, you know, Anna Politkovskaya, you know, who came here to Sydney, to the Sydney Writers' Festival, and said, and people said to her, you were frightened of being killed. And she said, I guess it's a reality I live with. And sure enough, Putin's birthday, I think, she was murdered, you know. Yeah. I mean, try being a journalist in Russia. Try talking to people who try to be journalists in Russia. Talk to Garry Kasparov. Just please, you know, try to give a balanced report. If you want to sidle up with, you want to do a deal with a dictator or an autocrat, you know, I guess, you know, a lot of people would say, well, this is real life. This is what you have to do. Mm. United States did a deal with Uncle Joe Stalin, you know, during World War II, and allowed him to run Eastern Europe until the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Mm.
This is real life. This is realism. Okay, but let's not pretend it's, you know, Disneyland, you know. It's, if we're going to do something as distasteful as that, let's at least call a spade a spade.
Do you think there's been a change in foreign policy outlook under the Trump administration, both one and now two? Do you think, despite, you know, criticisms that one could make, there was a need for a necessary correction after, you know, those 30 years of foreign interventions in Libya, Syria, Iraq, and the rest of it, which didn't, I think, from any objective measure, go as according to plan, and that there's a necessary skepticism now about being involved in these foreign conflicts. Isn't there something to the idea that the mainstream right just got a little bit utopian about trying to, you know, reshape the world in its own image?
I think the realists always believe that there's a space that to manage or understand or devise foreign policy, you have to be cognizant of the arguments of both the realists and the idealists. And I think, you know, the thing about realism is that sometimes it doesn't take account of values and the importance of values. The trouble with idealists is simply that they try to do things that are impossible and that the road to hell is invariably paved with idealism. So somewhere between those two is a viable foreign policy. I think in this case, the correction, I mean, if you're going to, I think whatever you do, you're always better off being truthful first to yourself and your people. So trying to pretend that Putin's some nice guy is just absurd. You know, this is the guy who tosses his critics out of the top windows or poisons them. And trying to pretend that somehow the war in Ukraine was caused by the Ukrainians, what, because they actually behave like a sovereign state? Well, you know, then just say it. You know, Putin will not tolerate Ukraine being a sovereign state, and we will back him on that. Pretty ugly, but if that's what you think is best, then at least have the decency to say what you are doing. And that seems to be the position of that part. You know, the part of the, because let's be honest, the Trump administration is completely conflicted at the moment. There are people who support Ukraine and there are people who support Russia, and they're both advising the president at the moment. And so, you know, it's not, I mean, it has looked like those who support Russia have been dominant, and they put Tucker Carlson and now Steve Witkoff obviously in that camp. But how it plays out is not clear, because Putin is not playing ball with Trump. He's not going along with Trump's "I'm the great peacemaker." You know, he's still firing weapons, because guess what? You know, it's all about him exercising his sovereignty over Ukraine. He's not about to be dictated to by America, or even to have it look like that. So I don't know. We'll see how this plays out. It's not clear to me. But I think this notion, what I would say, just to really get to the nub of your question, which was, haven't we had too much? We've had 30 years of forever wars. Mm. I think the reality is, all throughout, since the end of the Second World War, America and its adversaries have been engaged in you might call it the great game, in international, you know, backing regimes or not. And that won't change. It looks as if Trump just simply, rather than make America great again, seems to want to make America smaller again, as in reduce its international influence, to accept the rise of, or to accept the enlargement of the Russian sphere of influence. And theoretically, I think the idea is that he's going to win Russia over and re-engineer a Sino-Soviet split. I don't think it's going to be that easy. I think China, you know, will be able to play this to its advantage as well. And I think if Russia is given a victory, it will make it look like it will embolden it. So I don't know how it'll play out, but you know, the notion that this will end the forever wars, I think,
do you still think that, for example, the 20 years that the Americans and Australians spent in Afghanistan, and indeed the invasion of Iraq, I mean, have you changed your view on either of those two interventions? I have.
What I think is that you either back an ally, or you either support an ally or you don't. So we supported 100% South Korea since the time of the Korean War, which is why South Korea still exists. We withdrew our support, because Australia was an ally of the US in the war, and then we withdrew our support from South Vietnam. That is why South Vietnam no longer exists, for exactly the same reason. And it isn't about boots on the ground. It's about air support and critically intelligence and weapon sales. Now, if you think that selling weapons is somehow, means the military industrial complex, which lives from selling weapons and defending that part of the world, which we call the free world. So I think that Ukraine will survive if we treat it like South Korea, or it will not survive if we treat it like South Vietnam. I think Afghanistan would still be here. We had it cost, we as in the West, as in the United States, very little at the point they withdrew. But all of that went, and that has strengthened our enemy. And I think it's as simple as that, really. You know, it's just, are you prepared to stick by your allies? To make sure that when you go in, you want to be there for the long haul.
But are some of these not ideological conflicts like Cold War ones, but more messy ethnic disputes that more akin to like a Northern Ireland, which continues for 300 years and which there are good and bad people on both sides of the dispute. Aren't some of these disputes in the post-Cold War world more like that rather than South Korea or South Vietnam?
All disputes are like that. It's not some of them. They're all like that. Every society is a mess of ethnic, religious, and ideological conflict. The point simply is, are they on our side or not? And, there is no doubt in my mind that for however little Afghanistan looked like Switzerland, it was in a better situation and it was better for us ultimately as its allies in 2020 than it is now. And that's not even just, although of course it is partly about little girls being able to go to school. I mean, why do you bother to project beyond your own borders, which is what the US does and which is what all of those who consider ourselves to be allies of the US are doing? Why do we bother to have a free world? You know, I mean, when you look at it, you get down to it in the first place, we can't. How did this all come about? You know, under the British Empire, it's about guaranteeing the freedom of the seas and so forth. It was built on a whole lot of goods, public goods, you know. But you make up your mind. Are we better or are we worse off than we were? And I think most of the time you can make the argument, people will say, oh yeah, but South Vietnam was corrupt. Yeah. You know, Ukraine is corrupt. That's sick. Funnily enough, this is sort of the talk that always comes up. Oh yeah, you know, Afghanistan is corrupt. Yeah, but are they better off on our side or the other side? Are we worse off having them as an adversary or better off having them as an ally? Corrupt or not corrupt? Corruption is everywhere, you know?
Yeah, I just wonder, some situations like in Syria, for example, it's hard to know whose side to be on in many cases.
Well, they are not on our side. They've been with Russia. Now they're under Turkey in both cases. Should we even try to alter that? I mean, they've been with Russia. There was a Syrian cosmonaut. They've been a Russian asset for a long time. And I make the point to people that Russia is so weak that it has been so weakened by its adventurism in Ukraine that it couldn't even hold on to Syria. So Turkey now calls the shots in Syria. And guess who's gone in to back up Turkey? Well, that'd be Qatar. You haven't gone on to my favourite bet, noir Qatar, possibly.
I know that was mentioned in the Tucker interview as well, and I've seen some of your Twitter posts. So I just direct people to those to get your point of view on those. More broadly though, Rebecca, what ideological elements of the Howard Bush era policy framework, in your view, in retrospect, were inappropriate and need to be discarded need to be discarded today? Because I sometimes find there's the never Trump Republicans in the United States, I sometimes feel like a lot of still a large portion of the centre right in Australia is still on that page and hasn't really kind of like moved on from that. Do you think there's?
I see what you're getting at. Look, I was, and you would have seen my articles in Spectator, but I thought Trump, I think I wrote a piece when he was defeated in the 2020 election, saying I think I come to praise Trump, not to bury him. Looking at the positives, I mean, for me as a climate skeptic, that was obviously a positive for me. The war on woke stuff, which was there in the first Trump period, was a positive. I mean, on the whole, economically, America was doing really well. I mean, the big question mark I had towards the end of the Trump era was the way in which it came to me he allowed himself to be steamrolled in his management of COVID. I thought his instincts were right, that he listened to the wrong people. And that ended up being diabolical. I am one of those people who thinks that, I think the balance in probability, in my opinion, is that the COVID, whatever you want to call it, pandemic was so convenient to Trump's enemies that I find it hard to believe that it was all an accident. And it was so convenient to people who were developing mRNA vaccines that it's hard to believe it was an accident. So I just sit and wait and we'll see, how
it will play out. I remember distinctly when it became a political issue and there started to be a left-right divide on COVID. And I thought, once that happens, people are never going to approach this in a sensible way, because it will become like a climate change issue where it's people aren't willing to budge their sides. And once that happened, I was like, brace, this is going to go on forever. And whether the extent to which there was certainly some commercial interests that and political interests which benefited from that debacle,
back onto the, I think right, that's true. But talk about Trump and the people who dislike Trump, so I came to Trump feeling like, supporting a second Trump victory and hoping for something like the first term, but concerned about some of the foreign policy issues, and they've played out. I am concerned about them. I think it's naive to imagine, as some realists do, that Ukraine never had a right to be an independent country. It should always have just seen itself as, Belarusia, as Putin's puppet state and buffer state. I don't think Ukraine has ever looked like that. Ukrainians hate Russians. You go back to the Holodomor. The millions of Ukrainians were starved by Stalin, and Stalin, they say, and I think with a lot of reason, that he did it deliberately because he hated them and he hated that they were sort of intelligent, more sophisticated society than Russia. And so all this stuff about, this is the mother culture. Yeah, well, they seem to have a few mother issues. That's what I think out there. So look, this is a battle that won't be won or lost, I think, however it plays out is over the next decades, but the notion that that will be it and then Putin will be happy, I think, is pathetically naive.
I think that the center right in Australia likes to pick the things from Trump which essentially a Jeb Bush would have agreed with: cutting size of government, whacking woke, affirmative act, because it's affirmative action, the DEI stuff. Republicans have been battling that through litigation and stuff for a long time, actually. Maybe not as dramatically as Trump, but they've certainly, it's not a change in direction. All the drill baby drill stuff, that was a Sarah Palin slogan from the McCain era. That's not new. But what was new is trade, immigration and foreign policy, and a bit of questioning about the sort of liberal policy framework. And that's the stuff in Australia, at least I see, the traditional center right, you sort of don't accept or don't agree with. and are resisting in the same way that the never Trump Republicans are in the United States. Foreign policy is, you know, complicated. It depends on the particular circumstances. I think you can make a case some of the foreign policy adventures of the last 30 years were a bit, I mean, Libya, I mean, you know, a bit misguided, right? Oh. So there's that. Then there's trade, which is a big topic. You still think that free trade with all is the best solution in all circumstances and all geopolitical environments? I mean, what limits do you place on that?
Well, I think that, and this was an argument within the first Trump era as well. I mean, I think people who are protectionist usually ignore the downside. They just they don't take it into account. So, for example, free trade is ultimately a freedom issue. If I want to buy, we used to protect shoes in Australia. It just made it really expensive to buy shoes from overseas. So when I was growing up, buying a pair of Italian shoes was a bit of a, oh, wow, what a luxury. You know, free trade becomes an issue about why shouldn't I buy? If I want to buy Italian shoes at the best possible price, why shouldn't I? Why should I have to support a tariff barrier to protect poorly made shoes in Australia? And guess what? If we don't protect it, the people who make crap shoes will go out of business, but people who make good shoes will stay in business. So, I'm quite unabashedly in favour of free trade as part of a freedom agenda. And I think people, if you look at the United States, if people imagine somehow who support Trump, that Trump's trade tariffs, that this is going to be good for America but bad for other people, well, guess what? America's growth has been downgraded already from 2.6% to 2.2%. Blocking off trade, all tariffs are is a tax. So show me a person on the right who likes taxes, and I'll show you someone who maybe doesn't belong on the right. You know, like, why do you want to make things more expensive? They say,
Sorry, go ahead. But let me push back a little bit, because I mean, Robert Gordon Menzies believed in tariffs. He was on the right. Oh. He believed in tariffs against Britain, not only. So people who talk free trade today, should we continue to have zero tariffs on all Chinese goods coming into Australia? I mean, to me, that doesn't seem a prudent approach. Yes, it's a tax on goods crossing a border. We have very high taxes in Australia directly on income. And it seems to me what the Trump administration is doing is trying to, you increase a tax. It's a recalibration of tax. In the Republican era of Abraham Lincoln, there were zero income taxes, but high tariffs. And it seems to me that's the direction he's heading back to. So overall, try and keep the taxes as low as possible, but where and how they're levied has to take into account your geopolitical situation and who you're trading with, doesn't it? I mean,
sure. I mean, look, there are separate issues there, but on the point of trade, I mean, take for example the tariffs that are being put on Australian aluminium or Australian steel. You know, it's kind of crazy, really. When they were talking about it, I sort of had to go back to first principles. Why should Australian aluminium be cheaper than American? When we know that the biggest input cost for aluminium is electricity, and electricity is so much cheaper in America than Australia. Mm. But guess what? You know what? Australia, even, and it's not because of the subsidies, although I don't approve of those subsidies to try and compensate for our electricity getting more expensive. I think we should just have cheap electricity, you know, in the obvious old-fashioned way of generating it cheaply through burning coal. Like, guess what? More than 50% of the world, and much more than 50% of the world, is doing at the moment. But even with that, our aluminium and our steel is much less protected than American aluminium and American steel. Who suffers? Who do you think we sell our aluminium to? One reason why we can still compete in a market where aluminium is being flooded, the global market, prices set globally, being flooded by subsidized Chinese aluminium, we succeed because we produce high quality and we sell it to customers like Boeing. Do you think it's going to benefit Boeing to have, you know, an increase in the price of the aluminium it uses? Is it going to benefit the US car industry, automobiles, to have to pay more for aluminium and steel? Why not have a look about why aren't Americans producing, this is a pretty blunt and, in my opinion, stupid tool. It might, theoretically, it might protect aluminium manufacture. But if there's a real reason why aluminium isn't being manufactured in the States, all it will do is push up the cost of those goods which are produced in the States using imported steel and aluminium. And you have to question,
Okay, I remember a lunch, I've mentioned this before on other podcasts, but I remember a lunch in Hong Kong where Peter Costello came and addressed an Australia Day function. And he said, I keep speaking to these Americans and they're worried about China producing all their automobiles. And, I don't care if China produces all America's automobiles. And I remember thinking, cheaply. And I remember thinking at the time, mate, it does actually matter if China produces all America's automobiles. It does matter if China were to produce all of America's planes, if Boeing was to sort of relocate like other industries have. At some point, freedom isn't the only perspective for which to assess whether a policy is good or not. You have to take into account.
Absolutely. Of course. But the point is that these tariffs do not do that. I mean, how does harming the Australian exports of aluminium to the United States punish China?
I think
if you want to take it on a trade point, you could say China is dumping. Dumping is when you sell a product at lower than it sells in the country. So you've got anti-dumping things that you can aim at China, or you can say China is our enemy. Okay, but how does this trade policy which attacks Australia benefit either Australia or the United States? And by harming Australia and the United States, doesn't that just help our enemy?
I think you should. My thing is, you can obviously have closer trading relationships with societies and economies that are more similar to yours, and they should be different with those countries that are different to yours, right? At the moment, we trade more closely with China. We have zero tariffs on manufactured goods coming from China than we do from Italy. So that doesn't, to me, seems a bit incoherent. And also, you've got a situation where you have this very butchy talk in Australia about going to war, you know, subs and then going to war with China. But at the same time, bipartisan agreement that we should have a trade agreement where 100% manufactured goods come in duty free. There's an incoherence there.
I agree with that, but that is not addressed by the Trump tariffs. And it's not, I mean, tariffs are only one tool that you have. You can have tariff barriers, you can have non-tariff barriers, and you can have other regulations. So you've got a swag of things that you can do. My argument is simply that from a commercial or an economic point of view, which at the end of the day is important to people, because, you know, if the cost of living goes up, it hurts them, that you should look at all of these tools very carefully to see the pain that you're inflicting and who you're inflicting it on. I think, what irritates me about, and you can probably see this as a constant theme in this era, in this interview, is that I hate it when people are not truthful. So I hate it, you know, when people are not truthful about COVID. I hate it when people are not truthful about the cost of tariffs that is borne by the people that you're representing and by your friendly nations. And I hate it when people lie about saying that a drug is safe if it's not safe. But I also hate it when Trump says things like, poor America, let's level the playing field. When it comes to Australia and America, we have a free trade agreement, which we honour 100%. There are no tariffs. And we signed up to that agreement knowing full well that America protects its agricultural industry, like its beef. We do not have free access to the beef market. We get a certain amount, which is great, and I'm very grateful for what we get. but let's at least be honest. Everything above the quota gets a tariff rated quota, and they're threatening to give us even less. Well, you know what? We're a small country, small in terms of our population. We have to sell on an open market. It was ever thus. We've never had unfettered access to the US agricultural market, to the EU agricultural market. We've got together with a bunch of countries, the Cairns Group, to try to fight for free trade in agriculture, and it's been hard. And if Trump gives us less access, you know what? We've lived with it. We will live with it. But let's just at least all be honest and don't carry on as if somehow it's Australia's done something awful. No, you're just protecting just like you always have. And it just means the beef is good beef is more expensive in America than it should be. But hey,
I think close allies should trade much more freely than you trade with people who are have a different political and social system than you do. And I think I'm more in favor of the Trump tariffs on China and other parts of the world that are not Switzerland, are not Australia, and there should be much closer relationships with those, trading relationships with those who are much more similar. So I think you can have a more of a nuanced opinion. The other issue that Trump has changed direction on is on immigration. And we in Australia have always been tougher on illegal immigration compared to the US, and it sort of boggles the mind when you speak to people like Mark Krikorian, who's from the Center for Independent Studies, how nuts illegal immigration was in the United States, and also how the Bush era or even Reagan era right talked in sort of very utopian terms about everyone can come to America, and in a way that we never really did here. We were much more sort of realistic about it. But on mass immigration, we have had incredibly high numbers. It blows the minds of people in the UK when I tell them, 30% of people in Australia were born overseas, whereas in the UK they're worried that might happen in 2040, and they're worried about it. And it's the numbers are a lot lower in the United States. I mean, do you think in the Howard era the numbers were too big? And what do you think of the numbers now?
Well, I think that the key issue about immigration is integration. And for a long time, integration, talking about immigrants integrating into Australians, that was a dirty word. You weren't allowed to talk about that. Somehow that was like racist, you know. The word before integration was assimilation. And that, you know, but I think there has to be a recognition that we have created a great country here that it's based on really important values, that if the people who come to this country do not accept those values, do not recognize that that is why the country is both free and prosperous, that it will be neither free nor prosperous. And so I think there needs to be the number of people you can accept each year has to absolutely depend on the ability to absorb those people without, creating hardship for the people who live here already. So my issue is that you have to, A, insist. It has to be fundamental that people who come here want to see the continuation of the country that is here, not to change it, not to change it into the country that they left behind. And I think that's a big part of the problem that we face at the moment, is that people coming here who want to turn it into the country that they left behind and bring all the wars and dissension with them and bring values that do not simply are incompatible with our values. So I think unless you address that, you're playing with, fire. And Australians have shown time and again that they will not accept this. They will not accept that this is a country that's built by immigrants. But the immigrants have to share the values, and we have to be able to house people. And if you have a housing market that is so tied up in regulation that you can't build houses, then you cannot bring in more people, beyond what the capacity is to provide, for them to have houses, to create businesses or job, to work and so forth. So I think Australia really has over the years done a good job. I think it's way too much at the moment. I think Labor hopefully recognises that, but Labor's mistake has not just been the quantum of a million people in 2 years, but it's who they've brought in, and bringing in 3,000 people from Gaza, I think, is something that we will all regret.
Yeah,
if we aren't regretting it already.
My question is always, even if you have the best policies in the world, you know, John Howard abolished the Department of Multiculturalism and changed the Department of Citizenship. It was all good stuff. But if you have 300,000 people coming a year, it overwhelms your capacity to be able to, like, assimilate those people with the best will in the world. And, you know, people will naturally want to bring and are attached to their home country and the rest. And so it takes a while for people to intermarry and, you know, bury their parents in the soil of their new country and really attach themselves to the new place. And it's very, very hard with those massive numbers. But yeah. Final question, Rebecca. I mean, how do you describe yourself politically these days? Because I think a lot of the mainstream right in Australia are either, you know, anti-Marxist liberals or Gladstonian liberals or anti-woke liberals. But there's very few, and it's almost an unrepresented school of thought, that Disraeli and conservatism, which is skeptical of liberalism. There's a great quote I came across where he says, liberal opinions are the opinions of those who would be free from certain constraints and regulations, from a certain dependence and duty deemed necessary for the general and popular welfare. Liberal opinions are very convenient opinions for the rich and the powerful. Do you see where he's coming from, and whether the liberal, you know, intelligentsia in Australia might do well to sort of, you know, tap into that sort of Disraelian conservative thought a bit more in this new era?
I think that to the extent that it's quite hard to define. I find it quite hard to define myself in those sort of political terms, and you do end up almost saying what you're not rather than what you are. I strongly identify with, and I think probably.